Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hi, everyone. It's Steven Schleicher at Majorspoilers.com. Before we get into this week's Zach on Film, I just want to tell you that I'm really appreciative of everything that everyone does to support the Major Spoilers cause. And I want to give a shout out to our sponsor this week, HelloFresh. HelloFresh, it's cooking made easy. Now listen, I know how it is. You come home after a long day and you don't want to cook. Well, HelloFresh makes it easy. They get all the ingredients, everything that you need to make a fine, delicious meal. They pack it up and they ship it directly to you. And all you have to do is just follow the directions. 35 minutes or less, you have a great meal. Now listen, this is a great thing. If you're single, this is great for a family of four. But if you're single, maybe you want to do movie night. Maybe you want to watch Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and you want to invite your friends over, and you want to cook them a nice meal. HelloFresh.com has got you covered. You can feed a family of four or four of your friends. All come over, have some great meals, maybe some shrimp or chicken or steak. They've got it all. Or maybe you're a vegetarian. They've got that, too. HelloFresh.com. Listen, when you head over to MajorSpoilers.com, and you click on that link for HelloFresh, or if you go over to HelloFresh.com, and you use the checkout code MAJOR50, you're going to get 50% off for our new customers. It's quite a deal. It's HelloFresh.com. You sit down, you enjoy the meal, then you go to your home theater, your big screen TV, whatever it is that you do to watch your entertainment, and you kick back, and you watch the film that we talk about this week on Zach on Film.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. So you're down on your luck, and you're on a trip to strike gold after a kooky old man filled your mind of fancy. Well, let us... make you reconsider your idea as we talk The Treasure of the Sierra Madre on Zach on Film.
Oh man, America must suck.
Why is that?
Because here we have Americans flooding into Mexico because that is where the money is. That's where the jobs are in 1927. Well, this movie isn't about gold. It's about all these people coming out of the Great Depression who can't find work. They can't find work as migrant workers picking oranges or doing any of the labor in California. Mm-hmm. And so they all migrate down into Mexico in hopes of doing the work. And that's kind of where we pick up with our protagonist.
You can't call them our heroes, but you can call them our protagonists.
That's where we pick up with Fred Dobbs and Bob Curtin, Humphrey Bogart and Tim
Dobbs
Holt.
Dobbs and Bobs.
They are destitute on the streets of Tampico. And every time they turn around trying to get work, they're either being scammed to doing, you know, like weeks of free labor.
Yes.
Or they're asking for handouts for a meal and a haircut.
Did you stake a fellow American to a meal?
Yeah. Do you know who that was?
The guy that was giving him a coin the whole time?
Yeah.
No, I didn't recognize him.
Oh, interesting. We talk about directors inserting themselves into movies. That's John Huston. That's John Huston. Where do you remember John Huston from in another movie that we've seen in the Zach on Films?
Humphrey Bogart did The Maltese Falcon.
Yes, as a director, but where else have you seen John Huston at?
Oh.
Oh, is he the Huston that has a problem in Apollo 13?
No. John Huston, his daughter and would have been before this around Maltese Falcon.
Well, but in 1974, as an actor, You would have seen him as the father in Chinatown.
Mr. Gitz.
Yeah. I remember talking about that.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So, yeah, he's palming, you know, begging money off the off the streets. And then they come across, what's his name? Howard, this old timer, who's talking about gold. Interestingly, probably something that few people get to do. Few people probably get to direct their own father in a movie. So Walter Houston plays Howard, directed by his son, John Houston, who also is in this movie. And he fills their mind with these tales of gold, that he's been all over the world hunting for gold, and he knows that there's gold around here. His nose knows.
And
only needs is some money.
And it really, if they would have actually listened to what he was saying in that place, they would have been like, this is the worst idea we could ever have, is to go with this man and try to find gold. Like, this man found gold, and now he's with us. Why would we want to go do that?
Yeah, because he comes out and says, he says a lot of things. It's heavy foreshadowing, this book. First of all, like, I've made fortunes and lost fortunes, right? Gold turns people evil and makes best friends turn against one another, and people die over gold.
Being like, oh, I would totally leave once I got enough. I would decide how much I was going to have. I got it, and I'd be out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you knew that wasn't going to happen.
It's interesting, though, right? Because you want to like Humphrey Bogart, right? As a a good character. I mean, we've seen him as somewhat morally ambiguous in Casablanca.
Yeah.
We've seen him play, you know, kind of the straight up in Maltese Falcon. And then we see him here, and he's a freaking bastard with a capital B.
Right.
Because he's like, nah, you know, that had never happened to me. I would never. I'd say, yeah, give me, what did he say originally? $5,000 is enough for me.
25.
And then whenever he starts finding, it's like, oh yeah, $75,000, $100,000. Let's play this mine out.
Sure. You're old. You can. Survive off $25,000. I'm young. I have a lot. I gotta spend a lot of money.
Like $25,000 in that at that time.
God, that would have been like,
that's a lot of, that's like $11 million today.
Probably, especially in gold, and they probably wouldn't have had to sell it all.
You could have bought like 2,000 VHS copies in 89. That would have been awesome.
Yeah. Well, VHSs were like $185.
And in 1947, they were like $10,000.
Yeah, you had to actually buy the 35mm print.
They were made a few.
Listeners, this is a reference to our last Major Spoilers podcast where we talked about Batman 1989.
Yes. It's a good listen if you haven't listened to it. Now, we were looking. It doesn't look like Batman was on the National Registry, is it? Did you look it up and see?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Oh, okay. But maybe it's a movie that should be on the National Registry.
Yeah,
You can go listen to the Major Spoilers podcast, episode 579, Batman at 25. But today we're talking about Treasure of the Sierra Madre, 1947. What? Or 1948. 48. So what is... what do we get out of this story, or what are we supposed to get out of this story?
Oh, so you're like, not like, what's the plot? You're like, what's the thesis of the story?
People go into the mountains of Mexico looking for gold. They strike it. They strike gold, not nuggets, but gold dust. And greed gets the better of them. And in the end, the gold is gone.
Right. So certainly, like, one of the prevalent ideas of Treasure of Sierra Madre is greed is bad.
Is it? Yeah, I think it is. I mean,
I'm pretty sure they kind of put that out there of they had enough. They could have walked away. They would all have been fine. You know, they probably wouldn't have been all dead at the end. Well, one of Humphrey Bogart's character dead.
Yeah.
They probably would have all gone off and live relatively happy lives. All of them would have gone on and lived relatively happy lives with the money they had obtained. But then greed gets the better of all of them, starts tearing them apart, and they get in some bad situations. They're willing to gang up and kill some dude they barely met who's kind of nice. They're like,
he kind of tries to
weasel his way in.
Yeah, he basically tries to extort them into giving him money.
Sure, that's true.
Yeah, he comes into camp and says, look, I'm pretty sure there's gold around here. I know you guys have been digging for it, and look, there's three options. I go back into town, tell the Federales what you're doing, in which case you're going to lose all your gold.
Yeah.
Number two, you can bring me into your situation, and I'll only take 25% of the gold starting from now, not 25% from you've already dug up.
Seems fair.
Or you can all kill me.
You're right. And so they're all going to kill him.
Yeah.
And then they don't have to because the banditos show up.
Yeah, yeah.
And we get that wonderful moment. Batman.
So
is
greed
not
is greed is bad, but is it? But is it more that money is the root of all evil? Because everything that they do that's wrong revolves around money, and everything that everybody does in this movie revolves around money. I mean, here you see the rich American on the street giving mm-hmm. handout. Mm-hmm. You see mm-hmm. the little children begging for lottery tickets. You see the banditos who are really more after.
Weapons,
but you know, if they happen to find some money, they would certainly take that as well. And then, of course, you've got our three main characters who are just obsessed with money, 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 money.
I think the real thesis of the movie is that seeking wealth is pointless. And at the end, that's kind of where we end up, right? Mm-hmm. It's like one of them's dead, and the two of them are poor.
Yeah.
Right. Like if there was no point. Everything mm-hmm. that they did was for nothing.
Yeah.
By the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the movie's saying.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because had Bogart's character lived mm-hmm. and had they all lived and all gotten their share equally, who would have been in the poorhouse first?
Oh, definitely Bogart.
He would have spent it before he got out of Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I'll bet you $105,000. Yeah. You go to sleep before me.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's
crazy.
Oh,
I mean, he goes off the deep, dark
insane.
End.
He starts a little off, though. I mean, even in those early, you know, the first moments of the film where you see him kind of stake out a fellow American, he's just got this edge of I don't know. Bogart in this movie is really weird for me because usually he's kind of, you know, square jawed heroic. And here he's kind of got a squirrely Jack Nicholson sort of Bruce Dern vibe about it.
And that's probably the first thing, like, because we started, you know, we're watching this movie for, this is the first time I've seen this movie. And I was like, oh, another Humphrey Bogart movie in which he's going to play basically the same guy. And I was very happy to see him not play Sam Spade.
Right.
When you start seeing him kind of like already start like giving him like buggy eyes to the things that like the old codger is saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, this is a different character.
And he really comes off more as a New York loudmouth than mm-hmm. the San Francisco Sam Spade, which is a little bit more calm and reserved.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely.
And it is super interesting
and
to
it,
see
like,
him play
well,
that.
And that's the other thing is that he's like, he's boastful. He's very talkative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when they have that attack on the train, they go, you know, everybody grabs their guns and shoots out the side of the train.
Aiming
and then,
at nothing.
And then afterwards, he's like, I almost killed that guy, but then the train jumped. I could have totally gotten that guy. It would have been great. It would have been so great if I'd gotten him, but man, that train jumped.
Yeah.
And
like, everybody else is like, dude, we just got hit by robbers. Like, calm down.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, and I think that Bob Curtin, would have gone off and done the orchard thing regardless.
I think you're right. You know, can I tell you something about Bob Curtin?
Sure.
He's played by Tim Holt.
Right.
I've never seen this movie before.
Really? None of you had seen this movie before?
No. Until we started this discussion, I frankly did not know that Tim Holt was a real human being. Because the only time I've ever seen Tim Holt is in cowboy comics from the 1940s. I did not realize that Tim Holt was a person. And not like a fictional character like the Rawhide Kid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my story about the Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Not a fictional character like Gene Autry.
Exactly. Or Audie Murphy. You know, it's really weird to me to go through this and put that, just have something like that put together. Because just this weekend, I was going through our expensive comics. And I'm like, Tim Holt, number 46. I'm never going to sell that thing.
Interesting. Well, maybe it's people weird. Will buy it now that they know.
Buy it, because he was in the Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Howard, I think, was just happy just having a little bit to get by. I think,
or just happy for something to do.
I think.
Well,
was,
I think
yeah,
he was
happy
to be out there.
He was happy for the adventure.
Yeah,
he liked being out. And I think that, you know, when we get to the end and you get that terrible, terrible scene where he starts laughing, had Dobbs been alive, I think Dobbs would have killed him right there.
Yeah. Probably.
Because that scene really tells you what you need to know about him. It was never really about greed with him.
It was about the adventure.
Yeah.
It was about the journey.
Yeah. Do you think he actually expected to walk away with money?
No.
Because he seemed, he just knew that they were all going to snap.
There's the point early in the movie. And again, it's a lot of foreshadowing stuff, kind of heavy handed. Well, maybe not it's back 1940. Then it was heavy handed, but today it's very heavy handed.
It's very subvert.
But, you know, it's like, hey, I've got the money. We're going to pitch in together and let's go in, pals. And they do the handshake and then you do the cut in to Howard just kind of looking at him back and forth. And you can just tell right then he's like, yeah, this is going to end as a disaster, but I'm going to do it because I'm in it because I want to go have fun.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also, I don't know, maybe I was reading into it, but there's also kind of an expectation that he's not going to make it back. And,
yeah, he's
and
he's
I think
old.
He's okay with that.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to approach it.
He wants to go out on his own terms. Yeah. And if you get, you know, if you really look at Roger Ebert apparently said that part of this film is about the implacable nature and its effect on people. And you can definitely see that, too, when you get to the ending. But I think you can really see that in the character of Howard because he kind of it's not necessarily fatalism, but he kind of has this expectation of, well, here's what I'm going to do next.
Mm-hmm. Right.
About him. It's not necessarily he's not making plans. He's not I'm going to be rich and here's what I'm going to do when I'm rich and I'm going to kill anybody who doesn't make me. You know, it's something where he's kind of an older man. Maybe it's perspective. Maybe it's, you know, the expectation of his own mortality. But he's just kind of out there doing his thing and kind of happy to do his thing. And he really is kind of the one who gets the happy ending.
Well, yeah, I mean, for him, he gets to go back to the village and he gets to be their medicine man and be their doctor and just kind of live out the rest of his life. He's okay with that. And, you know, Curtin gets to go and hopefully make amends with the widow of the man that got killed, not by him, but
the widow
helped,
Jones.
Yeah. Were you surprised that Humphrey Bogart's character died?
No. By the time he dies.
I mean, because he's such a big name
that
he dies before the movie's even over. I mean, there's a good 20 minutes after he dies.
By the time he dies, like, there's two things. By the time he dies, it's clear that this character's not going to make it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's like, he has to die. There's no way that this character's going to come out the other end of this movie.
Yeah,
And then the other thing is that this movie does a lot of weird things that you wouldn't expect.
Like
spending 15 minutes with characters just speaking in Spanish in an American movie.
So this was one of the first, you know, one of the very first studio films to actually go out into a location. And in this case, to Mexico to shoot. Now, there's a lot of stuff that was still done on set and
Burbank.
In Burbank. But yeah, we get to this point where, first of all, it's been such a long time since I've seen this movie that I actually remembered the ending differently. I thought Humphrey Bogart's character did live, but he was tied up by the robbers, and that the other two and the people came riding out and saved him. But by the time they got out there, it had all blown away and they were all just went crazy at the end. But yeah, so seeing him die was still, I was like, oh my God, I don't remember that happening. And then for 15, 20 minutes, it's all in Spanish. Yep. Non-subtitled Spanish. It was intentionally done that way.
Yep.
And it makes this movie feel more genuine as opposed to really bad. Well, we do get really bad English spoken by I think he's credited as Golden Hat or whatever in the credits.
Gold Hat
by him. But there's no attempt to force that in down the audience's throat. It's just like here are native language speakers speaking their native language. And if you guys can't understand it, tough. It should be simple enough for you to figure out what's going on, but tough. And I admire John Huston for taking that approach, just saying, I'm going to do it this way and screw you guys.
And I wonder if they weren't, if they didn't write the movie and then when they were getting ready to shoot it, they were like, guys, there are no English speakers in this scene. Are we just going to do it in Spanish? And they were like, probably scratched their beards and said, yeah, I guess we can't introduce another character now for them to translate it into English. So,
yeah, but they could have done subtitles at that time.
Yeah.
Subtitles could have been very easy for them to do, but they opted not to do it. And I think from a standpoint, it's a very brave way to go in this movie. But my understanding is John Huston kind of had a love for that region and the peoples. And that would be really in line with that view.
Both of those moments are kind of subverting the modern storytelling model. You don't kill your big name. I mean, if you look at, you know, G.I. Joe Recalibration a couple of years ago, Channing Tatum got famous at about the same time they were making the movie, Channing Tatum's character had died. They supposedly, and this is, you know, partly word of mouth, they went back to reshoot that because Channing Tatum was now the big star. And they rewrote parts of the movie because you can't kill your big star.
Yeah.
You know, but here it works really well. And I think that's the major part of the reason.
I wonder if that was a draw for Humphrey Bogart. I mean, in African mm-hmm. Queen, he's kind of a not so good person, but he's still the hero and gets to make out with what's her face. And I wonder if there wasn't
Catherine Hepburn.
Yeah. You know, what's her face?
Yeah. Lauren by Hepburn call.
Probably tastes like a salty peanut when you kiss her. But Steven. I would imagine that he was interested in this because he does play a vile character mm-hmm. and he does die.
Yeah.
And just to say, hey, let's take a chance on this. I'm going to take a chance on this role.
Well, it's kind of like Brad Pitt in Snatch, right?
Yeah.
It's like, he's kind of, I mean, in Snatch, he's definitely not the main character.
Right.
But he's still most prominent in the poster.
Yeah. So it's interesting because this is the first time that you have all seen this movie. Zach, did you like The Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
What did you like about it?
Well, I liked that it seemed like a modern movie. It didn't seem... Well, I don't know. I think that was probably my opinion before we started all this thing, that modern movies have some weird kind of plot going on. I don't know. I really just liked it. I liked that Humphrey Bogart died. I think that's a risk that any filmmaker is going to take in any time to make a movie. If they're going to kill one of the biggest stars that's making films at that time and just kill him off with like 30 minutes left of your film... I think that's, and I really love the inclusion of Spanish in this film and how they used that, and they didn't subtitle it. Like we've already talked about, I thought that was great. And I don't know, I just thought it was good. I think they're to 1948 audiences, there were probably super big twists in the film, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the way everything panned out, and like he mentally breaks down, is willing to kill his friend, willing to kill everyone to kind of keep this money. We know now that it was like super obvious, like,
right?
Mm-hmm. When they start talking about gold and how are things, he's just talking about like, oh, so this is the
yeah.
So we all know that's going to break down.
I was still surprised because I couldn't understand a thing that guy was saying.
Oh man, I love that.
Out of the
corner.
The
old man.
Yeah, the old man.
Oh, Howard.
Houston. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Did you like this movie, Rodrigo?
I liked it a lot more than I expected to.
How come?
Well, for one, I think it moves pretty fast.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
I was
considering it's about panning for gold.
Yeah.
In the desert.
Well, I mean,
they're there a lot longer than you realize in the film. They talk about it. They've been there for like months.
Yeah. Almost a year. Like almost a year.
Yeah. So when did what was the last movie we did?
Searchers.
Yeah.
When did the Searchers come out?
I want to say 57.
56.
Right. So there's
about
this,
8 years later.
There's this expectation that older movies are slower mm-hmm. and newer movies are faster. Mm-hmm. That's not actually the case.
Right.
I would say The Treasure of the Sierra Madre moves 10 times faster than The Searchers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just like vignette, 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 end.
Right. Yeah. Right.
It's not like, look at all the mountains.
Right, right, exactly. Even though it was shot on location, you get to see a lot of Tampico,
mm-hmm.
just kind of, but it's all part of what's happening.
Right.
You know, they're in the city, then they're outside in the desert. You get to see a Gila monster. That's cool.
Yeah.
My favorite character in the movie.
I'm stealing your gold, everybody.
I'll be back later in the picture.
Give me a little bite.
So I enjoyed it. There's a lot of, talk about the movie being racist. I think it is, but only because the most prominent Mexican speaking role is Gold Hat.
Yeah.
Again, an unnamed bandito character.
Right.
Even though it's set in Mexico. But I would also argue that the movie is set in Mexico, and because of that, even if it was accidentally, we get to see a lot of Mexican people.
And that's
a lot
what
of Mexican
like
people
it.
At different social... like, if you watch a movie like The Three Amigos, which is super mega racist, like...
Everybody's
the entirety, the entirety of Mexico seems to be composed of adobe huts.
Yeah.
But in this movie, you're in Tampico, which is a major city.
Uh-huh.
And things are better in Mexico than they are in the United States. You see Mexican people wearing suits you know, Mexican ladies wearing nice dresses. You also see poor Mexicans. You see, when they go out to the frontier, you see kind of
farmers and border towns
and things like that. You see Mexican Indians, which again, probably not portrayed in the best way possible, but also not portrayed in a deliberate derogatory way, like, for example, the American Indians in The Searchers.
Right.
So it's this movie strikes me as having no bad intentions.
Right.
And like a lot of movies that don't have bad intentions and still turn out to be racist, like, for example, The Three Amigos. This movie, through that philosophy, actually does portray some positive aspects about Mexico that you never see again any movie.
Do you think a lot of that comes from the genre of the film? Like, The Searchers was a Western film that had an idea of what this certain ethnic group is like, and we're just going to pound that into the ground. And I don't think this movie was like, Mexicans are bad.
Right, right. And well, that's
unlike The Searchers, like Native Americans.
Well, I wonder, do you think, and let me ask you this about Gold Hand, because he does come off, and it's one of the most famous lines that gets messed up.
Right,
you know, the line that everybody remembers, badges? We don't need no stinking badges, right?
But the line is actually like three lines longer than that. Yeah.
I wonder, because of the way he is the leader of the gang. He's pretty smart. I'm wondering if he's not doing all of that as a put on for these dumb Americans.
He's fronting. Yeah. The big tough voice. I don't know.
He could be.
That's what, but, you know, I agree. That part, his portrayal, I felt was, I was like, well, I'm somewhat off put by that. But then I started thinking, well, what if he's really doing this as a, oh, you know, the hat off and the hands. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. American Man. I don't know anything about what you're talking about. Come on, let's all be friends.
Right.
When he does do some very evil things throughout the movie.
I don't know. I think he, like, if you think about the stuff that they end up doing, is they basically, 20 of them try to kill 4 Americans.
Right.
All of but 3 of them get killed.
Right.
Only 1 American dies.
Right.
Then they get a bunch of gold, which they just think is sand. Yeah. They don't recognize it, so they throw it away.
But that was also set up earlier in the movie.
And then they get shot.
Right. Well, they actually kill 2 of the 4 because they kill the newcomer to the camp.
Oh yeah,
and then later they kill Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
But then again, early in the film, you know, those guys are walking around fool's gold, pyrite, and Howard says, no, here's what gold looks like. You don't recognize it because it hasn't been processed yet. Sure, that's not our role. You don't, it looks like dirt.
Yeah. I don't think there's any real redeeming quality to the Bandidos. Again, if you want to find a redeeming quality for this movie's portrayal of Mexico, you just have to make sure that you look at every Mexican character that you see. You know, the real honest guy at the depot who is like, those are not your donkeys, right? He's Mexican.
Yeah.
But he's not the guy that gets quoted in the movie.
Right.
The federales that are just like this completely draconian, faceless group that just finds bandits, shoots them dead, moves on.
Right.
Also Mexicans.
Right.
You know, it's like, but there's lots of different portrayals of them, again, because the majority of the cast is Mexican. We get some kind of, you know, in a way, accidental.
You get a spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spectrum.
And that's nice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Spanish spot on, I'm assuming.
Yeah. All Mexican Spanish. Everybody, like every person who speaks Spanish speaks it well. And in fact, the Indians, like the guys that kind of adopt the old man have a manner of speaking that is typical of that kind of northern Indian when they speak Spanish. Wow. So that's at least authentic in the sense that the if it's not actual people that speak like that, that they hired, the actors they hired knew well enough to put on that accent.
And
right?
because they shot on a location, they were probably hiring locals.
Yeah,
I mean, probably had some little acting experience.
Yeah.
It's too bad that 1948 audiences and probably today's audiences will never know that.
Well, and
without
this
show.
And that's
which
and,
I find interesting because, again, as we said, the last 20, 30 minutes of the movie, all in Spanish, it's like, I had no problem with it.
Right. And it's like, you know, the what would have made this movie better? Is like what would have made this movie 100% better is if the old codger was Mexican.
Yeah, that would have been, that would have been interesting, except that he'd already been a world traveler. And I'm not saying that Mexicans aren't world travelers. I'm just saying in the context of this movie, it makes sense that he's still kind of this white guy that has been traveled the world.
I mean, in the context of, like, it all makes sense because, and it makes sense that a bunch of Americans would clump together. And it's like Americans just want to deal with Americans. And that's another good point is like, not all Americans are good.
Right.
Not even just Humphrey Bogart's character, but very early on, they get taken advantage of by an American, and they fall into his trap because they're because like, they're an American.
Do you think if old Prospector Man would have been Mexican and said, do you think in the movie those two characters would have latched onto him and said, take us to gold?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Unless they had established that greed a lot more strongly. Like if he, if he was like, yes, I know that there's gold, but also that would have fought against like the that prevailing attitude that like that the locals didn't know what they were sitting on, right? Which is this this like amazing like colonial idea that spans back for like thousands of years. Is like an invading force shows up somewhere. Like these savages don't know what they're dealing with,
right? Right.
And that's that was true with the British. That was true with the Spanish. It was true with the Visigoths. It was true with like the Angles and the Saxons before they became the Anglo-Saxons and then invaded this country.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting though. What I did like though is that the old guy has been around long enough to where he understands Spanish or understands it enough and speaks it enough.
Yeah, well enough. And he speaks it. He speaks it with a huge American accent, but he speaks it well.
Right. But what I like is when Curtin has to go into town, he's having trouble pronouncing the words in Spanish. So it's not like, oh, I need some frijoles. I need 14 kilos of frijoles. And then, you know, he's going off and rattling it off in perfect Spanish. I like that he struggles to say.
And you can imagine the old guy writing it phonetically for him.
Yeah. And so I mean,
almost like it's like he, you know, he had been in Tampico around or around Tampico for a while, too. So he might have known the numbers, but maybe he didn't. Like, I can imagine the guy writing out. Yes, he says instead of putting a 16 because you know, he'd be like, crap, how do you say 16?
You know what's even more impressive about that?
What?
Howard speaks Spanish. Walter Houston does not.
Nice.
Yeah.
So he learned his lines phonetically, memorized them phonetically. Basically, they hired someone who spoke Spanish to read the lines for him appropriately. And then Walter Houston memorized those readings. And that's what you hear him speaking. He does not speak Spanish, which I think is pretty awesome.
Matthew, you said this is your first time watching. What did you think of this movie?
I didn't care for it visually for a couple of reasons.
It wasn't directed by Francis Ford Coppola. Just keep that in mind.
Well, that's I understand. That's just one of my berserk buttons. I have many. Now, I didn't like it visually. There's kind of a breaking point for me around 1949 or so, I find, of whether a film is something that I can kind of submerge myself into or whether it's something where I sit there analyzing how I would have done this film differently. The version that I saw of this film was 2 hours and 4 minutes, something like that. And I could have easily cut it to 1 hour 25. And that's, I mean, that's my biggest problem with it. It's not that it's not interesting. It's at a very different, very leisurely pace. And I love the fact that, you know, there's those whole sequences that make it clear that part of the impetus to make this movie was just to show off, hey, I love this part of the country and all this awesomeness about it. And I love the, you know, the decision to have your big star character kind of be the jack wagon and croak. But I think that for me, it's one of those movies that I see why it's important. I understand why it's important. I don't think I'd watch it again of my own accord, even if I bumped into it on like Turner Movie Classics or something.
Yeah. I find if I found one kind of like, I'm sure there's many plot holes, but the one that kind of threw me the most was these guys got lost on the way back to the city or back to the village. Yet they'd been going back regularly for supplies.
No, they were going somewhere else.
No, they ended up in the same city. But at the end of the movie, they ended up in the same city.
But I believe their initial was, let's go to this other big city to sell all of our gold.
Okay.
They were going to go to...
Because that was...
Durango?
I don't know. That was the one thing that was just like, how can you guys be lost? You just need to go to that town, then go to the bigger town.
Right.
And that was the thing that threw me on that. But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie even after the long break. And I think it's because of the long break and I was able to just forget about it, that there were still some surprises in the movie. So I like that a lot.
You know the little Mexican boy at the beginning sells him the ticket?
Yeah.
Robert Blake.
Yeah.
Beretta.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of cool. Yeah.
Yep.
Let's give a shout out real quick to our associate producers for this week's Zach on Film. They are David Chang, Justin Labey, Trevor Wright, Kayla Brown, Devin Pelich, Iaz Faruqi, Phil Stoner, Casey Box, Derek Chin, Iaz Faruqi again, Benjamin Dignan, Lars Berg, Taylor Forbes, Bao King, and Adam Mickelson. Thank you one and all for donating to Major Spoilers and being our associate producers this week for Zach on Film and helping us make great things more often for you.
Maybe showing up twice on that list because they double donated.
Oh. Double donator.
Because we only have the $2, the $5, or the $10. And some people want to do $20 just because they're awesome.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So that's probably why sometimes you hear the name showing up or seeing the name show up twice.
Mm-hmm. You think you only pronounce the second time better?
You would think, but you
pronounced it differently.
Yeah, I know.
were there any techniques that you could pick up from this, Zach? And then after you kind of share some of those ideas, I want to go into something that I've seen recently and something we've talked about before. So
no, I actually thought like, what can I learn technically from this film or just from whatever? And really just the idea of keeping the Spanish in there natively, no subtitles, really stuck with me because I think there's this idea. And I'm sure it was prevalent through all of cinema, but I think it's very prevalent now that we have to dumb down our stories for audiences so they're very like homogeneous and everyone can accept them. But I think producers and executives don't give audiences enough credit. I think audiences now are consuming more media than ever before, and so audiences are very savvy to plots and ideas and all that kind of stuff. So I think audiences are probably smarter now in film than ever before.
Yeah.
So I think they should be able to take more risks on a major scale and be rewarded financially or critically or whatever they're seeking, mainly financially. And I think they certainly took a risk by eliminating an entire American audience essentially by not speaking any English for in the last 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
I think that was a big risk and just kind of walked away with that from this.
Okay. So one of the things that we kind of talk about, we talked about in class, we talked about here, is that you study film and you look at film like Treasure of Sierra Madre or whatever else that's been on the list, and you study that and you look and you can see what you can learn from. When it comes to lighting, we've talked before that one of the things you should do is study the old masters, the old painting masters, not old film, but study the old painting masters and look at how they capture light and how they're able to reproduce light and how they're able to shape a painting. And if you study the masters, you should be able to take, like the light's coming in from the window and it's lighting up this person this way. And then there's bounce light coming off the wall over here and that creates a nice soft fill. And then there you can see how the light glints off of here and that creates these very specific looks.
Right.
And, you know, I heard that whenever I was in school. Rodrigo probably heard it when he was in school. This is something that's been around for forever. Study the old master, study the old master, study the old masters. There are some masters that we don't know how they did their techniques. And one of the great masters, and some people say one of the greatest painters of all time, is Vermeer. And if you've seen his stuff, and this is usually whenever we say, hey, study the masters, people start showing you these pictures of Vermeer, they start showing you the paintings that he did, where, I mean, it looks realistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, photorealistic in many cases. It's like, how does he capture this light? How does he capture the subtlety? How does he do all this stuff? And people have had theories. There was a book written, I want to say like 15 years ago or so, called Vermeer's Camera, where they basically said, well, at this time in the 1600s, people would have had a camera obscura. Telescopes, mirrors would have been very popular. And so it would be very easy for them to do a camera obscura, which is just a big black box that you step inside with a hole in it and the light projects through, and they would just paint on the wall, or they would draw on the wall or on their canvas that was projected on there. And that's how they got their pictures, except for Vermeer never did any drawings. Most of the guys that wrote Vermeer's camera proved and showed that you could draw and sketch everything and then bring it out of the camera obscura and then paint it normally. But none of Vermeer's paintings ever have any of these drawings underneath. Mm-hmm. And so it's confused people for a long time. There's a new documentary out that I think you really should take a look at.
Okay.
Because it really shows someone's dedication to understanding, really truly understanding how something works and how something is done. It's a documentary that's just out. I think it's just out now on video and on iTunes in the last month or so, because I remember hearing about a month or so ago in one of my podcasts, maybe on Twitter or something. It's called Tim's Vermeer. And it's about this guy who says, I want to know everything about how Vermeer did this painting, and I'm going to recreate my own painting. But here's the cool thing for me is I listened to part of the story and it just never passed through my mind until I was really reading the synopsis for this thing and said, Tim Jennison is an inventor. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't tell you in the synopsis that Tim Jennison is the founder and creator of NewTek.
Oh,
you know, the guy that does 3D Lightwave, the guy that does the TriCaster and the video toaster, the guy that spawned a whole video revolution. This is his story. And I've met Tim. I've talked with Tim.
Oh, really?
We've had drinks together. He's a really fascinating, interesting guy, really super laid back. And so when I found out that it's somebody that I know that I've had some kind of personal contact with, I was like, oh, now this is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And because I know you like the TriCaster.
I do.
And I know that you've messed around with some toaster stuff. Sure. I figured you'd get a kick out of that, too, in that tie in the story. I figured Matthew would get a kick out of this because the movie is produced by Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
And it's directed by Teller. And it's narrated basically by Penn Jillette. And he talks out of
I was going to say
out of performance.
Like, he would either be an excellent director or a terrible director.
No, if you go to the shows, he talks to you outside the show. Awesome. And I've met Penn and Teller before. So I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Let me see what he has discovered. So throughout the whole course of this movie, Tim is trying to figure out, and he does this, and this is how long it takes him. It takes him from 2008 until the end of 2013 to study this process, set up the process, and then complete the process. So he spends years trying to figure it out, and it suddenly occurs to him that, oh, this is a mirror reflection. And if I use a mirror reflection set up in this such a way, and if I paint in such a way that I can recreate a mirror. And Tim is not a painter. That's the other thing that's amazing is he is not a painter.
Right.
And he sits down with Jillette and says, I want to show you how this technique works. And he sets up a little photograph in this mirror and he starts painting and just smudging paint around. And he does it for about an hour or two. And by the time he's done with this in an hour or two, maybe 5 hours, maybe, I forget what it was. But he has painted a picture. This person who's not an artist has painted a picture that looks exactly like the photograph. You can tell it's a painting, but it's an exact copy of that photograph. And then so he sets forth to try to recreate Vermeer's music lesson and do it in the exact same way that Vermeer would have done it in the 1600s, 1627, I want to say, is when the picture came out. And so he goes about and, well, he can work and he and his wife can remake the costumes that were used in that picture. He can go out and find an old cello that was used in that picture. But in order to get the glass just right, he's going to have to learn how to become a glazier.
Oh, gosh.
In order to get this piano just right, he's going to have to learn how to rebuild a harpsichord. You think that, oh, well, it took him all this time to do research and testing and all this stuff. No, the bulk of this time is building the set that he's going to paint and in the process having to learn how to do metallurgy, how to do, clothing,
awesome.
How to do all this stuff. And he teaches himself how to do all of these things. Mm-hmm. He even goes to, Italy? He even goes to Europe to learn how to mix the pigments in the exact same way that Vermeer would have done. So he's using everything that Vermeer would have done. And then he grinds his own mirror in the way that Vermeer would have done this, creates his own camera obscura, and then he spends 121 days painting this recreation of Vermeer's music lesson.
Wow.
And it looks exactly, well, not, it's not exact because there's a little bit of changes. But if you were to look at it, and by the end of this piece, you're looking at this and you're going, wow, here is someone who has taken a technique and has figured out how that technique is done, because old artists would never scribble down what their pigment combinations are. It's
sure,
not like
sure.
you know,
they
today,
just knew it.
Today you just go over to Adobe's cooler and you can pull up 50 million people's different color combinations. No, artists kept all that stuff secret.
Right.
Only they knew that stuff. They didn't share it with anybody. So none of that stuff's written down.
Right.
So a lot of this,
they didn't get
literally,
they didn't get hits on Twitter. They didn't get any extra Twitter right. followers for divulging that.
Literally, techniques lost to the ages. And he figured it out.
Wow.
And he says what this is, and it's something that I was kind of taught because, again, I learned this because we had one of the early New Tech toaster systems. Mm-hmm. We could call New Tech directly and probably talk to Tim. back in the day, certainly probably could have called New Tech and talked to Will Wheaton back in the day, because he was actually in Topeka at that time working for New Tech.
The first thing I edited on was Speed Edit from New Tech.
Yeah, there you go. The interesting thing that he said that was told to me is that at one point there were two schools. There were people who did art and they only did art, and there were computer people who did computer stuff. And then there was a time where they kind of flip-flopped when computer technologies came in, and so you had scientists recreating, you know, 3D models and doing animation. And now it's kind of flip-flop back the other way, where the artists are doing the art and the computer people are doing the computer people stuff. But he said in this process, he's realized that you have to be a technologist and you have to be an artist in order to really appreciate and understand what's come before. Mm-hmm. And you really have to study. And he, I think at about day 85, they're doing an interview with him, and he's sitting there in front of the painting. It's only like 3/4 of the way done. And he's like, if I wasn't doing this for a film, I would have quit already. Mm. But I'm pushing through. And he actually makes discoveries that people had not discovered yet in this piece. Mm. But I think that's the thing that's good about this. We've been doing this for, I don't know how many episodes this has been now.
157.
We're over a year.
Yeah, over a year now. So over 16. A year now, we have been devoting time 80. To studying works and breaking down works and really trying to figure out how they work. And hopefully you're gaining something out of this.
Oh, sure.
And I think if you watch Tim's Vermeer is what it's called. He actually has a blog. He has a blog called timsvermeer.com.
I've already downloaded it and watched it.
I'm hoping that it'll give you a little bit of encouragement to say, hey, you're in the right direction, man. You're not, you know, you're not, this isn't for waste or for naught. Because here's somebody that painted a Vermeer that's his take on it, but it's done in the same style and the same technique that someone 400 years ago used and is lost to the ages.
And that's definitely one way to approach it, right? You can dive in and just pick a film apart. You can recreate it, you know, the Psycho recreation, for example. You know, who cares what the critical acclaim for it was? Somebody went through and just separated every frame of video or every frame of film and then like put it back together with like different components, you know, like that's something there, you know, it's something else to watch 60 movies and then kind of close your eyes and say, when I think of every movie that I've seen, what are the things that pop into my head? Like that is the kind of what could become a style, you know, if you're like, what did I like it? You can, like I had a professor in, when I was in college, and he would relate everything to Spider-Man and Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Right. So, and those were like the movies that he would always show us scenes from. He's like, and it was a screenwriting guy. And it's like, and you could tell that that was his style.
Right.
It's like the movies that you go to, the scenes that you go to, that you say, this was powerful, this was interesting, this was good, this was formally good. This didn't work out. Why didn't it work out? That's kind of how you build a style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're learning, man.
Yeah.
But if you want to see a documentary, and I mean, this isn't like this isn't Super Size Me. This isn't, Bowling for Columbine. This isn't this is a straight up documentary that has some funny bits in it. A little bit of cursy words, because at one point some stuff falls apart and Tim's just like, And it's just like, it's very funny. But here's an older guy who is like, I want to learn something new. I want to learn how something is done. And I'm going to spend the next 5 years of my life doing that.
You know what we should do? We should all put our minds together and try to figure out how they did that one Citizen Kane shot. Isn't it there that
the one where they go
through the window?
Yeah, we should make a documentary and make a lot of money.
You know what we should do?
Actually,
we should
figure out
have they really?
What all went wrong with the last episode of season two of Transformers, and we should try and make it into a coherent thing. We have to learn how to draw, how to animate. Steven will do the in-betweens. I'll learn how to do all the voices. Zach, you get coffee.
Okay.
Rodrigo, you're in charge of turning this mess into a coherent story. All right, everybody, break. We'll meet back here in 5 years.
It's another approach. You know, if you've seen Room 48, Room
43?
243. Yeah, the Shining.
The Shining documentary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I haven't watched that yet. I've got it.
That's 20 people scrutinizing The Shining, coming to wildly different conclusions.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there, just because that kind of that level of obsessive film analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Just even if it's kind of like even if it just becomes a mirror where you're saying like, this person is projecting their own crazy hangups onto The Shining.
Yeah,
like even that is like weirdly interesting and entertaining because people do that with movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing that kind of ties back to this: if you watch Zach's YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Major Spoilers video YouTube channel, but Zach's got his own little private channel where he posts his own little stuff. Occasionally, he'll put up little things that he's working on, just like little samples of, here, I'm trying this out.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell this is the exact same thing. Your latest one's the little bounce and stretch thing with the box.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were just doing that on your own to mess around, or if you saw somebody else do it, or whatever.
Yeah, it's been a long process of trying to figure out how to animate.
But see, there you go. It's a long process of me trying how to do something better. And I'm doing it by studying other things and seeing what other people are doing and then trying it out.
Now
that you've done it, you're happy with your results. And now hopefully you will apply that to a future project.
No, I realize I literally have been doing this the last week. There's this guy that posted a animated video about like the rules of animation from like the
little
Disney
box,
guys. Yeah.
It's an animated GIF.
He did a whole video for it. And I've been literally like trying to do like the first scene because it's all animation that I've never learned before.
Yeah. You should, if you want to be a better animator, the book that you want to get is Disney's Illusion of Life.
Yes.
I don't think it's in print anymore.
I'm sure it's online.
It's there. It's a huge book. It is like this thick. It is one of the best books on animation you will ever find, but it is probably like 12,000 pages long.
Lord.
It is super heavy. You will kill a young child with it.
I will kill a young child with it, or
yes,
I could.
It has been foreseen.
But it goes through and says, here's all the principles of animation. Yeah. Here's what they all are. Here's samples. And the best part is the book is just littered with art from the Nine Old Men, of their style, their animation, just stuff you would never see anywhere else. It's a great book. Disney's Illusion of Life. I would highly recommend it. I don't think it's in print anymore. I bet if it was in print, we could probably go somewhere and find it.
Yeah, you could probably go to like Amazon.com. But, you know, the best way to go to Amazon.com is through the Amazon.com link at MajorSpoilers.com. There's a lot of .coms in this world, right? It's like almost seems like a never-ending amount of
.com. But there's only a few that you need to know.
The first one you need to go is Major Spoilers, and then click on the Amazon one, and then go try to find The Illusion of Life, or is that what we called it?
Yeah, it's The Illusion of Life. It's by Ollie Johnson and Frank Thomas, to the Nine Old Men. There are some copies available, greatly reduced if you're a Prime member. You can get it from markdown from $60 all the way down to $34.80 for the hardcover, and you don't want to get it in the hardcover. They do have some other editions of this, but that very first one that pops up is probably the one you want. Although, if you wanted to spend the $100 on the brand new one, I would highly recommend it, because there's some gatefolds and fold-out stuff that you don't want. You want to look at it fresh. You don't want to see it after somebody else has gotten their slimy mitts all over it.
So if you would buy that through that process I've just described to you, it's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to help the site afloat.
So see, Zach, you're already doing it. You're studying it.
Yeah.
You're trying to recreate it.
Yeah.
You're trying to make yourself better.
Yes.
So go look at Zach's little Welcome to Night Vale animation.
That one's not very good.
But it was done before this one.
Yes.
So again, if we're going to go back and look at Zach's process of becoming better.
Yeah, no, I'm in the process of like putting together, mainly to make myself feel better about like where I am in my life, of like going back to my last project I did for university and putting all my graphic stuff I've done since then just like to make me feel better.
Go back and listen to the first episode of Zach on Film.
No, I don't listen to anything we record.
Oh, okay.
No, God. I am honestly
way to be on the company line there, Zach.
No, and it's for the idea of if I listen to it, I will hate it.
No, but then you'll say, look how far I've come. Look how dumb I was back then.
I know.
And look how brilliant I am
now. I can remember our discussions. You'd be like, okay, Zach, now, what did the color mean in Pulp Fiction? I'm like, oh, no. It was a lot of
what's
red
color
and stuff. And no, I don't want to go listen
say
to
it. What
I
again?
Feel bad about it.
Say what again?
I know what we're doing on the Road to Nerdtacular. We're just going to play Zach on film for Zach.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Zach, take us home and take us out of here.
All right, so we already talked about Amazon.com, but make sure to go buy all your stuff there. And that's pretty much all I plug at the end of the show. So next week, we will be talking High Noon when we talk Zach on Film.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out Pear.com today to learn more. P-A-I-R.com.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.